Hello, this is Terry Edom from Canada, the author of The End of Fossil Fuel Insanity. Talk to my friend Jason.
All right, thanks for joining the program here today, Mr. Terry Edom, Canada's greatest export. How you doing today, sir? What time is it up in Calgary?
It is 3:08 on a cloudy, drizzly day.
And we're June 1st, and you've got clouds and drizzle. Is your temperature above 50, sir?
It is a little bit, yes. Not by much.
Oh, that's a sad state. It's like 95 degrees here where I'm at, off the grid. Very first guest on the Off the Grid Office. Now, it's not our official Off the Grid Office podcast because we're producing a lot of different content for a variety of companies and websites and et cetera. We have a new podcast that we're going to have with Off the Grid Office. And I haven't even talked to you about this, Terry Edom, but I'd love to have you I'd love to have you on as a guest. You ready for this?
Uh-huh.
I haven't even announced this yet, so this is kind of breaking international news. It's like MTV. Premiere. MTV, a world global premiere. It's called the Don't Follow Me podcast. And so we don't want anybody to follow us. We don't want anybody to follow us at all, but we're going to talk about whatever we want, and we're going to have all kinds of conversations.
Well, if it's beyond energy, you can count me in, because energy is getting too much.
Well, and that's kind of really where it's spawned from, is that in the world of energy, and I'm sure other industries are like this too, but it's gotten really extreme, really polarizing, to where if you try to bring a middle-of-the-road idea, a middle-of-the-road conversation, a middle-of-the-road talking point, I mean, it is like you get your hand slapped with a ruler. I'm an old Catholic that went to a Catholic school with the nuns, so that's where my fears come from, not so much of the whip cracking back in the Egyptian days, which I think a lot of people still have embedded in their DNA. Mine comes from a Catholic nun. Whap!
Okay, well, there's some modern equivalent. Yeah. You're not wrong. It's the there's a lot of people in the industry that are working feverishly to reduce emissions and come up with a new technology or carbon sequestration or you name it. And at the same time, there's a camp of people who are so terrified by the climate change narrative that they are utterly convinced that fossil fuels have to go. There's just no place for them in any future, and they're the ones that are driving the bus. We see that with in the United States with your Department of Energy. It's entirely staffed with people that have no oil and gas experience, and a good chunk of the people want oil and gas dead. And we have that in our federal government here. They don't want to hear about solutions that work with the system. They want the old system gone. And I've talked to people that are in this space that are developing new technology, and they have there's a small company here, for example, that's developed a great new way to catch CO2 out of the exhaust flues of a natural gas fired boiler, say in an apartment building or something. It's a great tech. It works. They've raised money. They're selling these units all over the world. And if they go tell the federal government what they found, they're kind of like, eh, not really interested, even though it's like real and it's working and it's not even living off the government teat for financing. It's they're doing it on their own. And there's more situations like that where these companies come up with something that's incremental breakthrough, but they just don't get support because there's that core element of activists that want the industry dead. And then what they're pushing in its place just isn't there yet, and it's just so draining trying to deal with that.
What's happening with your oil and gas activity up there? Do you have much of it? I mean, you're out of Calgary, so I would imagine you have some.
So it's actually doing quite well. I think like our natural gas production's hitting record levels, and oil is right up there too. But Canada's kind of basically, you could carve it into three pieces. There's the oil sands, which a lot of people know about, the 170 billion barrels of reserves. And I think that produces about 3.5 million barrels of oil now. So a lot, like that's probably 60% of Canada's total. And that just keeps on chugging. It's been, they spent hundreds of billions of dollars on infrastructure, building the mines for the above the mineable portion. The big pipelines have been laid. And so that just keeps chugging forever because it has a reserve life index of decades. So that will just keep going. Then we have northwestern Alberta shale region with big plays like the Montney and the Duvernay, which are sort of equivalent to Haynesville, Permian type stuff. Just it's shale and there's endless running room, or not near endless running room, it seems like. And so those are doing well and growing, and there's enough pipeline space for them. And then kind of in between those two is like the old conventional system, which is all of the legacy stuff, which is a bunch of vertical wells, thousands and thousands of vertical wells, a lot of low productivity stuff, not a lot of growth, but just keeps chugging along. So those three sectors, the oil sands will keep going forever. The shale plays will grow until they exhaust all the sweet spots, and then they'll go into some sort of decline. And then the conventional will just keep going until regulations squeeze it out of business. And it's probably similar in the U.S. minus the oil sands. You have the big shale areas, which are doing really well, but someday they'll start to go on a downward slope. And then the conventional part is just going to get attacked more and more and more. So,
how different is the oil sands up in Canada from the oil sands down in Los Angeles? Is that the same kind of hydrocarbons, or are they a little different?
It's heavy oil. Yeah, Los Angeles is heavy oil, and it's more flowable, I think. A lot of what's in the oil sands is like bound to the sand, so you actually have to process it to scrub it off the sand. And like a lot of the oil sands, people don't realize this till you go up there, but it's at surface. Like it's literally like the world's biggest oil spill, and it's the mineable portion is right at surface. So you can grab these clumps of a handful of sand, which is black, and it's like sand that's been dipped in a bucket of oil. And so you have to, the trick is to get the, you have to heat it, steam it to get the oil off of the sand and release it. So it's similar oil to California, quality wise, but not the way that you extract it.
When it comes to regulations, environmentalism, climate change, I would say Canada was probably ahead of the United States by introducing a lot of the regulations on oil and gas and even fertilizer companies now with what Trudeau has done with some of the agriculture companies. Is that a fair statement to say?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. The reason I ask is that... do you follow like the Los Angeles and California regulations when it comes to that type of their oil sands? Because I just read where they're doing some more regulations and some more issues with that type of, and I think a lot of it has to do with the urban development close to it. But at the same time, any chance the opportunists have to advance their cause, They do that. So do you guys follow American regulations much in Canada, or do you guys lead the way?
Well, no, I follow the U.S. quite a bit. I mean, we, like the company I work for, we sell our natural gas into the U.S. So we're more like, as far as my business is concerned, my little business, we're more closely tied to the U.S. market than the Canadian one. And I follow the U.S. because the U.S., like, we're the tail and you're the dog, right? So like, even though we're leading in, we're ahead of you in some of the clampdowns on the industry, whatever, fundamentally what happens in the U.S. will drive what happens in Canada to a certain extent. Like, we've been able to squeeze our oil patch harder here and faster because it's really hard to kill. Yeah, they're try as they might. So but like the federal government here has placed like a regulation, like a carbon tax across the country. So you pay a carbon tax on any molecule of hydrocarbons you burn. We paid at the gas pumps. We paid on our natural gas home heating bills. And it just shows up as this boat anchor around everyone's neck, and it's growing every year. And it's going from bad now to unbelievably bad in 2030. So we're kind of ahead of the U.S. in that. Like, I think the U.S. has a lot of push back against carbon pricing. But then at the same time, you have states like California, like you mentioned, which are kind of ahead of the curve in the U.S. and they tend to drive things. And California is coming out with just the craziest of regulations, which even make Canada blush out. Like recently passed that law that any new, I think drayage trucks they call them, that haul truck in and out of ports have to be, if they're replaced after January 1st of next year, they have to be electric or zero emissions, which essentially means electric. There's no hydrogen fuel cell infrastructure yet. So these companies are being forced to replace trucks with electric ones. And the truck operators are saying, like, how is this possible? There's nowhere to charge these things. And the state is saying, well, don't worry, we'll get to that. Like, we've got incentives out there. People will build chargers. But you work your way back up that chain and you go, well, okay, if you build charging stations, where's the electricity going to come from? Well, don't worry about that. We're putting solar panels in. Well, wait a minute. That's electricity for 4 hours a day. Well, don't worry about the rest. We'll import it from other states or we'll put batteries in. It's like, well, wait a minute. Neither of those work either. And it's always the sequence of, well, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out. But you have
a bunch of, are these appointed or elected people doing this?
Well, that's the interesting part. You have, you have elected people doing some of it, and then you have unelected people doing some of it.
Like, so in let me just throw a flag here quick, because I just got off an interview to where what we did is we threw a flag out during our interview where we needed to do a quick little educational moment, you know, like a referee blowing his whistle. This is what we see in the U.S. The elected officials will appoint certain people, and then those certain people will do what the elected official basically says, right? And and what we've seen is basically elected and appointed officials playing business. Like they come up with an idea, they create a business plan, and then they start appointing this person and this person. And what happens is when it doesn't work, they do not disband it or look at why it doesn't work. They try to force it and they try to manage it harder, and they all of a sudden, and it just becomes a boondoggle. And anyway, that's what we've seen a lot in America.
Oh, it's true. And it's like, I was going to mention the EPA, I think, has put out a new standard about how gas or power generation has to have a certain, there's a cap on their emissions or something like that. And as a result, there's a lot of coal and natural gas fired power plants that are going to have to shut down. And the head of one of the big utility regions in the U.S., and I can't remember which one. He's the head of FERC, actually, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who's a Biden appointee. I'd like to emphasize that point. The chairman is a Biden appointee, and he testified before a Senate committee saying that there's a crisis coming in the U.S.'s power grids because the baseload reliable coal and natural gas is being retired too fast before there's adequate replacements. So you have this Biden appointee saying this, but you're right, there's this Frankenstein that's been created, which is making these rules up, saying, well, we're the EPA, and so we're going to make cleaner emissions into existence, and if that means shutting down baseload power, so be it. And the grid operator is saying, wait a minute, that doesn't work. And they're like, well, that's your problem. You have to figure that out. And it's insanity. And that's what's part of what's so draining about this, is that there's no place for reason anymore. It's,
Well, I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example here. We've been in America, we've been given money to the solar and wind industry for probably 20, 30 years at least. And specifically the last 15 years in the solar industry, I've been hearing about the terawatt of storage and it's going to be the next great thing. And so when I hear about these EV charging stations and I hear about this direction we're going, and whenever there's pushback and the answer is always, oh, don't worry, we'll take care of that technology when it happens. We just keep going. Just keep going. We'll take care of all those problems when we cross that bridge when they come, type of a thing. And when I look at their track record with like solar, this interview is actually being produced by solar. I use this little office, this little recording studio we have on solar, because it doesn't need a lot of energy. I do not have any of my appliances hooked up to solar. I do not have my cooking hooked up to solar. I use propane for that. But what I found was that a computer and a few iDevices, yeah, solar's not bad. Okay, I can rely on it for that. But I would never do that to raise a family. I mean, could you imagine trying to rely on something as unreliable as solar energy? And by the way, I say that knowing this whole podcast is being produced by solar energy, because we are going down that direction. But let's go back to the insanity part. Why live insane? You can't live insane, Terry. You can't. So... anyway, sorry, I got off on a really long tangent there, but comment.
Go ahead.
Oh, I would say your comment on really the government managed marketplace directing us to a place where we don't have the solutions created yet, do we?
No, we don't, and we compound them day by day. And here's a great example from the UK, from Britain, from yesterday, or May 29th. So the UK has a lot of wind power installed and a lot of solar too. Even though it's gloomy old England, they've got a lot of solar power. So what happened here the other day, in the middle of the day, there is ample wind and ample sunshine, and they had so much power during the day that they had trouble getting rid of their power, that surplus power. But they couldn't shut in baseload power because they were going to need it right away. They were going to need it to restart. And they won't tell solar panels to stop producing because you just can't do that, and wind. So they actually had to sell. They had to pay the continental Europe to take their power, 550 pounds per megawatt hour, which is like $500 per megawatt hour, to take their power. They spent £10 million doing that, balancing their power grid for a day. So this is the insanity that they're generating. They're building more wind and more solar. And the head of one of their grid operators said, this is going to happen. We have a big increase in power in solar generation on sunny days, and we're going to see this happening every sunny weekend we get where there's excess solar power. So they're creating this second or third order consequence that no one would have envisioned when they started mapping this out. And they're not even stopping. They're putting in more wind and more solar. And so they're creating these monsters, and they have no idea how to deal with them. And they're just going to create more. And it's going to hit U.S. It's going to hit California first, and then it's going to spread. And we're getting that here. You see that in Spain too. They have an excess of solar power during the day. They don't know what to do with it because you can't store it. And if you think you're going to build a battery fleet to take it all in, that's just not going to happen either.
It's so funny you say that, because I've actually changed my business so that I'm really very flexible between 10:30 and 2:30, because that's like literally 70% of the charge time.
There you go.
The sun comes up, it's the battery that I have, it tells you how much wattage you have being inputted, right? So it tells you your input, and it also tells you your output. So it's kind of neat, because when I'm charging like my iPhone, I can see that, you know, it only takes like 6 megahertz or whatever. And so it's kind of neat, because you can learn the different electronics and what it takes in real time and everything. But if you start to develop like solar anxiety, because if you don't charge everything between 10 and 2, man, you might be screwed till the next day.
That's true.
Well, if you don't have anything to back, so honestly, I'm backing up like car chargers. I'm backing up, the little swag chargers you get at conferences, you know, that gives you like one battery charge on your phone. So literally, I'm putting all that stuff out there to charge them, and I got neighbors coming by, and they're just laughing at me and having just a good old time. it's the baby, right? Steps, like that's
how it's going to go.
Well, yeah, it is, and then they'll have some device. I'm sure that'll be a trans. I'm sure there's some sort of transmitter now. I could probably get that would help me charge during different things. But I did have a question for you. What's going on with natural gas? You work for a natural gas company, or are you an owner in that, or you work for them? I guess what's your? I never have asked you that. I don't think.
Oh well, I'm a junior partner. We have a couple of guys in our shop here that own the bulk of it. So we're owned by employees and our board of directors.
Cool.
So
okay,
yeah, very hands-on group. So yeah.
So what's natural gas doing in the realms of business-wise for you and your area, and also environmental-wise? You know, natural gas was supposed to be the foundation fuel 10 years ago, and now New York's banning it.
Yeah, well, so it depends how high up in the sky you want to take a viewpoint from. So New York is banning it. There's parts of LA that are banning it. But the whole world is glomming onto it. I wrote an article the other week where I just cataloged some stats, and I called the article "This is the Century of Natural Gas," which is, some people in New York would dispute that, but from a global perspective, I think it's fairly indisputable. There's 103 countries which are currently developing natural gas infrastructure, either importing it or building pipelines or distribution systems. There's millions of miles of pipe being constructed. There's 150,000 miles of mainline transmission being constructed, which is something like five or six times around the world, that's being constructed right now as we speak. So to anybody that thinks that natural gas is declining on a global basis is not paying attention. We see it in pockets of the rich West here, parts of Europe and parts of the U.S. and parts of Canada where they think we can live without it. And they're pursuing some of these mandates. But again, if you want to get rid of natural gas, you have to have a replacement. And the grid operator that I was talking about earlier, or the FERC, was when they're saying that there's a grid problems coming because there's a lack of reliable energy, they're talking about places like New York and California and New England where they're throttling back all of these natural gas plants. The market itself is not great right now for North American producers because the price is so low, because there was a very mild winter, particularly in the Northeast U.S., which is the biggest consumption area in winter. And so they didn't consume much. And so the U.S. storage went comfortably above the five-year average. And so when that happens, prices head straight down until there's some sort of a supply reduction response. And we haven't seen that yet. There's been a lot of companies that have said, yeah, we're cutting rigs. But cutting rigs doesn't equate to a cut in production, not for many months. So even though there's some rigs being dropped, the gas rig count is falling somewhat. That won't show up in reduced production for months yet. So there's an oversupply. As the U.S. gas market is either straight up or straight down, it seems like, and it alternates between the two. And we're in the down phase right now, and it might stay that way for, I don't know, months to come yet. So.
How much of the shale plays in the gas market are connected with spikes? Because Western Colorado, some of the Pennsylvania areas, up in, I would imagine, your part of the area, Calgary, those natural gas is there, whether there's oil or not. And in a lot of the shale plays, a lot of the stuff that's being injected is what the natural gas is coming out. How much of that is talked about in the marketplace, I guess?
Well, I think the people that pay attention to the gas markets are kind of keep a close eye on these things. In the U.S., Canada's sort of inconsequential to the U.S. in most ways. Canada produces like 18 BCF a day of gas. The U.S. produces like 100. But in the U.S., what's most important is the three big shale basins. One is Appalachia, which is centrally in Pennsylvania and spreads mm-hmm. across into West Virginia and Ohio. That produces about 35 billion cubic feet a day. Permian produces about 20, I think, and the Haynesville, Permian and Haynesville are both in Texas, and they produce, Haynesville is something like 15 or 18. So between the three of those, they produce over 70 billion cubic feet a day, which is more than 70% of the U.S. market. Yeah. So those are the big three that really matter.
I always say Marcellus. I always say Marcellus when I mean Appalachia, because it's Marcellus, yeah, Utica, yeah, Appalachia. And yeah. Joe Sinnott is a regular guest out from Pittsburgh, and he always calls it the Appalachia now. We called it Marcellus a few years ago, but he has not called it that for a while. So they must be really, it's now the preferred nomenclature is back to Appalachia, yeah, Basin. Okay, I got to remember that for my future interviews. Got it.
Okay. The biggest reason for that is that there's a zone called the Utica zone as well.
Yep.
That's often co-produced. A lot of companies have Utica interest and Marcellus interest, but all it's flowing into the big system, and it's all essentially one big field. So it's so there's kind of two producing zones, the Utica and the Marcellus now. And that's
the one that's so shallow.
Called Appalachia.
Yeah, that's the shallow one where they get all the cool footage, you know, where you can start your faucet on fire. You know, we used to do that at my grandma's in Candio High County, Minnesota. We'd do that. Because that all that iron and sulfate and stuff in the well, you just crack it open so it just leaks the gas. And then some of them you could light on fire. It was kind of a neat trick to do with that. Anyway.
We have that in,
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Anyway, so those are the big fields that are kind of dictate how gas prices are going to go, essentially. Well, that and LNG exports. So I'll get to that in a second. But those three producing fields are they're so big that any changes in those can upset the market one way or the other. If they increase production by a couple of percent, then that craters prices. And if they decrease it by a couple of percent, then prices go through the roof. And then the LNG export is getting to be a bigger and bigger factor. I think it's about 15 billion cubic feet a day that the U.S. can export right now, and that's on its way to 25 or 30.
That's a lot of that has to do with the Haynesville, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the Haynesville stuff goes right onto a boat, essentially, because it's very local to that. And then the Permian is getting better connected.
Mm-hmm.
There's pipe being built as we speak to better connect Permian gas to the boats as well to get it offshore.
We've got
Permian is the wild card because it's what we call associated gas. So the Permian is mostly an oil field, but it produces a lot of natural gas too, as almost as a byproduct of the oil. So people produce out of a well, they want the oil and then they dump the gas. So they don't really care whether they get much for the gas or not to a certain extent. Because it's the oil where all the value is. So the Permian, like if the price of oil goes up and the price of gas goes down, the Permian will still keep increasing production because they make money on the oil. So that can compound the problem in the gas side by flooding the gas market. So
the Permian is, we've predicted on here over the years that it will do about 70% of the oil and gas production over the next 20 years. We've been saying that for the last 5 years, and it's starting to be that way. Lake Charles is interesting. We had Dr. Lauren Scott on the program. He actually writes the economic forecast for the state of Louisiana. He's been a regular guest on the program, and he was explaining basically some of the foreign countries, you know, like France, Germany, some of the other countries that have been building LNG export stations down in Lake Charles, because they can't rely on Russia for natural gas anymore, obviously. There's problems over there. And so with the Mississippi River, they can go inland a lot further than anywhere else in the United States. And so Lake Charles, the Haynesville, to me, that is such a wild card in the whole thing, because you are relying on exports. You know, we could have an export ban tomorrow if Biden wakes up and decides to, you know, do something erratic again. Trump, I used to make fun of because he'd wake up in the middle of the night and sling tweets and make the stock market go a certain direction just by slinging texts in the middle of the night. Biden, I actually think he has dementia. I've thought that for a few years, and I actually called dementia on Glenn Campbell when I saw him in concert a week before. He was at the Dakota Magic Casino down in Wahpeton, North Dakota for an event, and I was there for a radio thing, and I He kept forgetting his band members and his kids' names, but he knew every lyric to every song. And
really?
Oh, yeah, everybody thought he was drunk, and I said, he didn't slur anything. I think he's got dementia. A couple days later, it came out he did. So when I say that I think Biden has it, I really mean it. I do. I don't. Yeah. Anyway, my point is that I think Haynesville, because of the imported exporting stations that have been being built down there. To your point, countries like Qatar and some of these other countries, they have been building this hydrocarbon infrastructure for 10, 15 years. They're not going to just abandon it because the U.S. has got climate change up their rear now.
they're absolutely. And well, there's the whole rise of the BRICS nations. Are you familiar with BRICS? That's it's kind of a anti. There's the G7, which is the group of seven Western countries, which are kind of big and dominant in the Western hemisphere. And then there's this BRICS alliance. BRICS is B-R-I-C-S, which was short for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They started forming a trade alliance about 10, 15 years ago, and that's actually growing quite rapidly. There's a bunch of African countries that have applied to join. There's some in Asia that have applied to join. And it's just a loose alliance, but they're like, yeah, you know what? If Western Europe and the U.S. and Canada want to do all this crazy stuff, they can go right ahead. But we got to look after ourselves. We have to. They're going to look after their own energy needs. Saudi Arabia is looking to join this group too now, which is kind of a big ominous thing. And some of the Middle East countries. So they're forming this block of humanity, which is saying, okay, if those people over there want to destroy their own energy system, it's up to them. We're going to start trading amongst ourselves, and we're not going to let them dictate whether we build pipelines or coal-fired power plants. Everybody talks about how great China is doing emissions-wise. People forget or don't pay attention to the fact that China built, on average, two new coal-fired power plants every week in 2022. They built over 100 of them. So they put up a bunch of solar panels, and all of the greens fans go, yay, look at China, their model, but they don't want to talk about the coal-fired power plants. So China is securing their coal supply, China is securing their oil supply and their natural gas supply, and all of these countries are starting to do the same. And there's billions of people in that group. China and India alone, absolutely, that's 10 times the people in North America in those two countries. Or in the United States and Canada anyways, I guess Mexico is 100 million, but they have like 2.5 billion or 2.7 or 2.8, whatever it is now, billion people. The U.S. and Canada have 400 million. So we economically, the U.S. is still the juggernaut, but as from an energy consumption perspective, they have their own people to feed, and there are a lot more of them. So they have different priorities, and they're going to do what they're going to do. So.
Sorry, I was writing some things down here because I was not familiar with BRICS or BRICSA, if you want to put the A on South America. I thought it's funny they dropped that on the acronym. When you said South America, I'm like, wait a minute, there's no A in BRICSA.
Sorry, it's South Africa, yeah.
Oh, South Africa, but still, there's still the SA. This is interesting. That's an interesting group together in... The fact that India is in there, that worries me a little bit. India is a wild card when it comes to the economic.
Absolutely.
Are we in the economic warfare? Can we start calling it that pretty soon? Because when you were talking about, you know, these different alliances, and, you know, I'm talking about how Russia is using, you know, the pipeline as a weapon. And I mean, we're kind of in warfare, aren't we?
Well, we kind of are, but we have to be very careful. There's warfare of the conventional kind where we have a force and they have a force and you go toe to toe. But if you want to talk about economic warfare, people have to think through this chain here.
Yes.
If the West is committed to renewable energy, which is wind and solar, so where do the raw materials to make wind and solar products or equipment come from? It comes from China because we've farmed everything out to them. So there's a big push on now in the U.S. and Canada to develop a critical minerals inventory to develop our own mines so that we can mine all of these weird rare earth metals and tellurium and nickel and whatever else, that lithium that we need to make these the key to the renewable energy future. But the problem is we're reliant on China to process them for us, and processing them is a very dirty business. We don't want it here because there's a huge environmental footprint. So we let them do it out of sight, out of mind. So we're charging down this green path, but we're utterly dependent on them for the products to make this green revolution happen. And it's like, people, if you want to call out a warfare, like it's just like you, if you want to use an analogy, if we're in a war with them, it's like we buy all our ammunition from them. So how does that work in wartime? So that's, it is, if you want to think of it as a war, we're doomed because they control, we're selling ourselves. We're going 100% all in, Biden and Trudeau, on this green energy renewable utopia that we want to build, batteries and you name it. And China controls the critical minerals that go into it. And I think there's a little element of panic here in North America saying, okay, we got to get ahead of this. We have to start our own mines and our own processing or whatever. But how does that work out? There's all of these mines that get proposed in the U.S. and Canada, and they get shot down for environmental reasons. There's, I think, northern Minnesota or Michigan, I can't remember which one, there's a potential mine that was to be developed there, and it got shot down for environmental reasons. There's a lithium prospect in Nevada, which is huge, that can't be built because there's some rare flower growing in it or something. There's a ton of minerals in northern Canada that's off limits because it's environmental preserves or something. I just had coffee with a guy the other day that told me about, in northern Manitoba, there's a huge nickel deposit, and the federal government just put a new national park right over top of it, so it'll never get developed. So we don't even, if we're in a war, we've farmed out our ammunition manufacture to the enemy, and then we're not even helping ourselves to develop that industry at home. So it's not well thought out, the whole process.
Or it's thought out so well that there's so many roadblocks that only certain companies can do it at the end of the day. You know,
possibly, yep.
Well, if it takes 2 to 3 years to get a permit, and if it takes that type of thing, there's only certain companies that can hemorrhage and bleed that long and, you know, keep the checks cashed and the people fed before that happens. We experience it in the media. When I tried to educate people on this, because when a lot of the CEOs 10, 15 years ago were coming on the Crude Life talking about the paradigm shift, they meant it. They weren't, you know, using exaggerated language like the millennials saying amazeballs. No, they were saying, we're in a paradigm shift here. The next 10, 15 years, we're not going to be the same that we were before. And I knew what they meant because I came from publishing. I was a part of the first paradigm shift, at least one of the, usually the communications is the first paradigm shift. Well, that was when my business went bankrupt. My one business that failed, and I was really ashamed about having to go bankrupt. Well, then every single newspaper in America went bankrupt over the next 1 to 10 years afterwards, or the next.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't feel so bad. I was just one of the early small, you know, I used to say, I was in the third world of media, right? That's what I used to say, because I was a small little independent media company, right? And I wasn't the big monopoly newspaper or the, you know, conglomerate radio television station. No, I was just a little independent guy that, you know, did okay.
Yeah.
I was did okay. Well, when the internet came, well, everybody got everything for free. So nobody started, nobody paid anybody anymore. Well, then I saw either you got to become an ad agency or you got to become a distribution center. You had to reinvent yourself and you had to figure out something that you had to be something you weren't before. And so, like, for example, sorry, I think a mouse just went by my off-the-grid studio here, so we are really off-the-grid. came out of the ceiling, it ran across a rafter there quickly. But when you take a look at, you know, a newspaper, one of the things they should have done was probably got rid of the printing press 10 years earlier, because the amount of people that it takes to maintain it, the cost of the building around it, the amount of input that went to the printing press versus the output was ridiculous, but you couldn't let go of the old ways. You see what I mean? And that's happening in oil and gas in a lot of ways too. So when I hear companies down in South America say we're no longer an oil and gas company, we're an energy company. And I'm starting to hear, you know, ag companies say we're no longer an ag company, we're an energy company. What are you seeing out there for, you know, are you seeing companies rebrand themselves in a paradigm-like shift? And also, you can comment on the paradigm shift thing because you've experienced it both in media and energy, I imagine.
Yeah, well, my day job is no longer, my day job is new energy. My new title is New Energy Ventures. Like I'm working on carbon sequestration, on making renewable natural gas, on finding ways to capture the carbon out of our exhaust flues, like I mentioned, that little company. That's my full-time job. I'll tell you right now, I don't know, I know maybe one or two people under the age of 40 that are engaged in exploring for oil and gas. And I know hundreds that are engaged in new energy stuff. And every company has a new energy component like I do. And everybody is working nonstop on these various things, either reduce carbon emissions or generate hydrogen or capture and sequester CO2. Here's an example. There's a you mentioned carbon capture a little earlier. There's a company in Calgary that's developed a way to capture CO2 from a natural gas processing plant and inject it underground into a certain type of reservoir. They don't have regulatory approval to inject it into certain zones across the province. So it's kind of on their technology's ready to go. The regulations aren't there yet. This company has a line of clients out the door with checks in their hand saying, here's our money, take our money, come put your technology on our facilities. And this company was given, received an investment of $300 million from Brookfield, one of the biggest companies in the world. And they gave them $300 million and said, here, even though you don't even have a business going yet, and even though you don't even have the regulatory side worked out, here's money for when you do, because we want to be ahead of the curve. So the impetus there, the entire province of Alberta is being carved up into what are called carbon hubs, where there's going to be underground, or there's going to be centralized locations where carbon will be gathered and then pumped underground. And this business is unfolding, even though the regulatory side isn't even worked out yet. It's really crazy. There's companies that are spending money trying to develop, and I'm working on this myself, literally working on projects that are saying, where can we put this carbon? And the government is saying, we can't tell you yet, we don't know. So there's this regulatory, it's just like on the electrical side, people are saying, we want all the stuff to happen. And then there's a bunch of people building solar farms and saying, where do I hook up my solar farm? And the grid's saying, hold on, get in the queue, wait for 4 years. Same thing here, we're trying to capture carbon. And the government's saying, hold on, we don't have the regulatory side down yet. So it's literally like a gold rush in this industry, I would say, into the green energy world. But it's like everything else, the infrastructure isn't ready to match pace with it.
Explain the difference between the carbon market and the natural gas market or the oil market. Through the pipeline, I think a lot of people, they think, you know, oil is, you know, flows through like cream corn, and natural gas flows through like invisible things, and carbon flows through like they don't know yet, but probably one of those two type things. How do you explain to the layman the difference between those pipes and how it flows through?
So oil is a liquid, so it's non-compressible, and it flows at a certain rate depending on how big the pumps you put on it are and how big the pipe is. Natural gas, and generally with a natural gas pipeline, up to a certain extent, you can increase the throughput just by increasing the pressure inside there. It's a gas, compress it more, and then have higher pressure, and you get more gas through. Carbon dioxide, CO2, it's a gas too. It's the same thing. The problem with carbon dioxide, when you want to capture it from, say, an industrial, let's say there's a big factory emitting a bunch of carbon dioxide, and they want to sequester it underground somewhere. Well, the what's coming out of that exhaust pipe, only a portion of that is carbon dioxide. But so if you want to ship all of that gas down a pipe to an injection site, well, first of all, it's way too hot. You have to cool it somehow, but you also have to compress it, which generally heats it up again. So to put it down a pipeline, you have to take it from atmospheric pressure to a much higher pressure to get it down a line somewhere, but it's too hot. So you have to cool it and then compress it, which heats it up again. So it's a big engineering challenge. And then you have to build a really big pipe to move that exhaust gas flow out down the pipe. And so what's optimal, what you want to do is you want to take out the CO2 right at source, so right at the factory site or wherever it is, then just put that CO2 down a pipe. But that means then you have to replicate at every factory, you have to put in the technology to take out the CO2 rather than having it a central point, which makes more sense. So you could have a central injection site, let's say that captures from 20 different factories, and that would be optimal. You gather all of the exhaust gas at one point, you take out the CO2 there, and you pump it straight down. But then you have to build 10 massive pipelines with 10 massive compressors to get the gas there, which nobody wants to do. So the alternative then is to build 10 carbon removal devices at 10 separate factories and then just pump the CO2. Now that's expensive again because you have 10 sites where you have to build this equipment. So the engineering hurdles to these things are immense. Like if this is easy, it would have been done a long time ago. It's like an electric vehicle. It's like if it was easy, like the electric vehicles were developed before gasoline engines were developed, but they were abandoned in favor of gasoline because it worked better. And now we're trying to reintroduce it, and the same problems arise as storage, the charging, whatever else, and the cold weather, the fact they don't work well in bad temperature, high or low temperatures, the same problem. So on the carbon side, there's all of these very fundamental engineering hurdles, which people have known about forever, and they're, that's fine. But now the messaging is you have to solve it, and now, and it's just going to cost trillions of dollars.
When we're talking about the carbon and the carbon pipeline, is there a difference between the carbon? I mean, carbon is carbon, but I'm hearing, you know, ethanol carbon is different than crude oil carbon and natural gas carbon and all these different things in terms of trying to transport it. Do you know much about that?
I don't know too much about it. It depends how pure you get it. But I know pure carbon dioxide, I think, requires a certain type of pipe, just like hydrogen requires a certain type of pipe. I don't know about that. You could find a far smarter guest than I on that topic, but the pipes are somewhat specialized for sure. You can't just utilize any pipe for any purpose.
Mm-hmm. And do you have ethanol plants up in Canada?
Ethanol in terms of
fuel?
Ethanol is a very popular product here for, like, when wells freeze off, you have to use ethanol a lot.
Okay.
It's made up here.
The reason I ask is we here in North Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, there's a carbon pipeline going in, and I swear that the way you described what's happening up in Canada, I literally got done just doing an interview last hour that's going to air tomorrow on Bismarck, where the guy described that same situation happening with this carbon pipeline in the Midwest. And I'm going, wow, this seems very, very deja vu all of a sudden. where they basically are giving money to these companies that have really never done this before. Just, hey, go do it. Go learn how to do it. Go. Here's some more money. Pay us back or don't pay us back. Whatever. So,
it's true.
Yeah, it's a little crazy, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Who's doing it up in Canada, if I may ask? Who's kind of spearheading the carbon movement up there? Is it the oil and gas industry? Is it the agriculture industry? Is it a conglomeration of new companies? Or?
Well, I think by and large, not a lot of them are public yet, but what it looks like is happening is what we call the midstream companies, the pipeline operators, the energy products, the Kinder Morgans, I can't remember some of the other big names in the U.S., but there's a whole industry of companies that just, Enbridge, TC Energy now, they own pipes of various kinds, and that's their business. They own and operate pipes and processing facilities and pump stations and whatever, and they're getting into the business in a big way, it looks like. So every big carbon project that I've seen or heard about has the name of some big midstream company attached, and I think they're just looking, this is just a new growth route for them. They're like, oh my goodness, look at this, we can't build natural gas pipelines, we're not allowed anymore, we can't build oil pipelines, we're not allowed anymore, but look at this, we can build 10,000 miles of carbon lines and government will pay for half of it, and then we're going to charge a bundle of money just like we do on an oil pipeline. Like oil pipeline companies tend to be a very good investment because they usually have 25-year contracts with their customers at a fixed rate of return, and they just make money forever. And it's going to be the same thing with the carbon side here. There's going to be companies that are going to pop up that are going to own and operate carbon infrastructure or hydrogen or whatever, but carbon for now. And they're going to charge companies to transport their carbon from their whatever factory into an injection site, and that's going to be a good investment probably.
When you mentioned the term new energy, I haven't heard that too much. Is that more a industry term? Is that a Canadian industry term? Is that just
that might be just our company? That's my title. But me and the CEO, I was the CFO at our company, and then I moved over to this new role, and I work with our CEO, and he's like, "Well, what should we call you?" So.
Okay.
VP of New Energy Ventures.
Okay, well, it makes sense because I was the director of new media for like 4 years for basically a newspaper because we didn't know what else to call it, and then that did become the industry term was new media. Yeah, because we didn't know what to call the internet. it was a new thing, man.
Yeah, you went from newspapers to something new, and you don't even know what it is, right? And it's the same thing with energy now. Like energy takes a lot of forms, and at the end of the day, whatever's cheapest is and most reliable is going to win. And I think governments haven't really thought in those terms yet. They're of the mindset that there's a certain type of new energy or a certain type of energy that's going to win, being wind and solar primarily, supported with batteries, and that's not going to happen. And at what point do they admit that? I have no idea. How much ruination do they have to cause before they'll actually say those words? I don't know, but we'll find out. So
in conclusion here, as we kind of wrap up this international podcast with Canada's greatest export, Terry Edom, the author of The End of the Fossil Fuel Insanity, correct?
That's correct, yep.
Available on Amazon as well as other locations. Barnes & Noble too, right?
Yep, that's correct.
He also writes for the BOE Report, and Public Energy Number 1 is the name of his blog, if you'd like to be retro and go back in the blog days. So, you know, I'm doing this off-the-grid thing, and I'm partly research. Part of it is I actually value freedom more than money. And so a lot of what I do is freedom-based and very, very libertarian roots, you know. And I'm also, you know, I was raised a Catholic, and I was an altar boy, and I was even a Sunday school teacher. Oh, so, you know, a lot of my subconscious is basically Christian American, right? Yeah. So I'm doing this solar and petroleum and, I'm sorry, natural gas, and just a few, you know, a good mix when it comes to being off the grid. And I even to the point to where, you know, the other part of solar, if you don't move that solar panel with the sun, you ain't getting it much either. So you got to keep in mind, you got to move the solar panel too, on top of you only got a certain amount of time to get the solar wattage maximum. That's a different day. When I view government, Terry Edom from Canada, I view government, you know, is supposed to help the individual, empower the individual, become self-sufficient, to become a better citizen, to become, you know, a safer community. I look at what I'm trying to do of, you know, making my little patch of land off the grid as much as possible to be self-sufficient, so I'm not a deterrent on the grid, so I don't have to, you know, pay excess dollars into, you know, funding projects that don't exist with technology we have only seen in space movies and that kind of stuff. And I mean that, actually, because we are working on certain things that aren't even real that we've only seen in space movies. And so what advice do you have, or, you know, what's your upbringing when it comes to being off the grid and trying to be self-sufficient? Because you kind of, I mean, you grew up kind of a socialist capitalist, didn't you?
Well, I grew up on a farm, so I avoided politics like the plague, and it was a small, not wealthy farm, but, and we weren't off the grid, but we cherished our electricity. But like the home I grew up in had a wood furnace, and it was a combined wood and oil furnace. We would fill up the tank once a year with oil for emergencies, or when we were out and about for a day or two. And the rest of the time it was wood fired, and we weren't off the grid, but we grew our own vegetables. We recycled and reused absolutely everything that you could think of. And I have relatives that live like that, off the grid to the extent possible. And I admire people like that want to minimize your footprint. And I think that that's one of the saddest things about this whole environmental discussion, is that governments have strayed from that as an ideal. Like, can you live with a smaller footprint? Can you do more with less? Can you recycle better? Can you, and I'm not just talking about putting something out in a blue bin, but can you reutilize copper wire? Can you think of better ways to do things that are less wasteful, rather than a singular determination on CO2, which just that's just like a road to ruin. But the true off the grid lifestyle, and it's not for everybody, but is there ways you could minimize what you do? Like electricity is a good example. You have to build an electrical system that meets the peak needs of society, not the average, not the 90th percentile, but the peak. If a country uses 5 terawatts of energy on average, but the peak is 20, you need a system that produces 20. How could a government help shave that peak? Maybe they should charge people hourly, so that when the peak of electrical consumption happens around the dinner hour, 6 o'clock at night, 7 o'clock at night, there should be like real incentives for people to not do things at 6 o'clock at night. Say like, don't run your dishwasher, don't do all of these things, don't run your dryer, do it in the evening, and you'll get compensated for that. You'll get rewarded somehow. And that would lower the whole peak of everybody's consumption. And then maybe you could get rid of 10 coal-fired power plants. If you thought in that way, that was your goal, rather than saying we're going to crush carbon out of everything, then that's a totally different train ride. But the people that are trying to live off grid or minimize their footprint, I think that's the key to progress, because they think in terms of, what can I do with these old tires to make something out of them? On the farm, people used to make planters out of old tires. You'd fill it with dirt and there you have a planter, right? And a tractor tire makes a fantastic planter. It's reusing it, right? And it's just finding another use for it instead of making one out of treated wood. You have one there that lasts forever. Go try it. If you need a planter, and then you can grow your own vegetables, and they're black, so they absorb sunlight and they work even better. So it's there's all of these things that, like, these all of these publications about how to live off the grid. I love reading those. How to compost better, how to reuse pieces of wood, and I think it's just a great way to live. We're just moving further away from that. We're just becoming more consumer oriented, but at the same time trying to stamp out emissions in a wildly unrealistic way.
Hey, you looking for any business? Are you looking for any? Are you looking any business, either with your gas company or writing or any side hustles you got going on? Anything you want to plug?
Oh, well, I guess my writing is my only side hustle, but that's all I can have time for. But on the new energy side, yeah, we're open to any new ideas. As far as primarily, we're looking for better and cleaner ways to use our natural gas. We're looking for better ways to utilize all of our roads. We have a couple hundred miles of roads that connect all our gas gathering systems. We have a couple hundred well sites with space that we could use for something else. There's a lot of waste wood in the area. We're looking at making renewable natural gas out of waste wood in the area. We're trying all of these different things. So, but they're all very, very, very challenging things to do. A lot of the ideas sound great in concept, but to actually do it in reality is something else completely.
What is waste wood?
So when if there's a logging operation in your area, what they do is they go cut down trees, they cut all the limbs off, and they cut the tops off the trees, and they cut the butt off the trees because it's all roots and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they leave that behind, which can be as much as 20% of the wood in a tree, or maybe 25%, depending on the trees even. So you have these enormous piles of limbs and wood junk. And here in Canada, the regulation is you have to push it into piles and burn it every year because it doesn't decompose very well.
Get out of here.
No, it's, I kid you not. So every year there's, by government mandate, these piles of wood get burnt. And everybody who looks at it wants to weep. Because it's like, what a waste of wood, but it's way out in the sticks. It's like, this stuff can be like 50 miles from a paved road, so you can't haul it out because it doesn't make economic sense. Like if you load a truck full of limbs, you're not going to get very much on the truck, so you have to find a way to chip it up or something out in the bush, but then that adds too much cost and it's not worth it, so it just gets burnt. So where are natural gas operations are, there's logging operations all over. So when we look out from our well sites, or the operators driving to a well site, that we all we see is these big piles of brush that get burnt, and that drives us as crazy as anybody else. We're like, there's got to be there has to be value in this stuff somehow. Could you make wood pellets? Could you burn it and generate power, like in a centralized location? What could you do with it? And each one of those has its own hurdle. The wood pellets, it has to be a certain moisture before you can do that, or it has to be a certain grade of wood, or it has to be free of grit,
yeah,
and dirt, or it has to be dry enough.
It almost sounds like you need one specific company on site funded by, you know, the government for the first year to make, I mean, just to research what they can do on site. Because when I'm thinking of the geographical hurdles sometimes with some of the, I mean, sometimes you got to drive 3 hours up and down a mountain to get to an oil well. I mean, that's,
oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and so if you're in logging operations too, they're not in urban areas.
Nope. By definition, they're not in urban areas.
No.
Like California has the same problem. Like there's, I've heard from someone at a small startup company in California that's looking to generating biodiesel out of waste plastic. And they said every county in the state is bugging them saying, can you please get rid of our wood? Because California has this huge problem with wood waste that causes forest fires, right?
Yeah.
All this dry dead wood and stuff. And they're like, we desperately need a way to get rid of this, someone to gather it and make that makes economic sense. But it's a very tough hurdle. The quality of it and where it is the largest thing. Like you can gather it up, but like you say, if you're 3 miles down some mountain road, what are you going to do with a big pile of junky limbs?
Well, I mean, you're talking about, you know, somebody sitting there basically putting something into a chipper on site for hours and hours and days, and you know what I mean? That's the only thing that really, in like you, either wood pellets or mulch or in Benson, Minnesota, they take wood chips from their kind of their local Minnesota logging operations with the Benson, Minnesota turkey plant. So they take turkey poop, turkey waste, and wood waste, and they power the town, basically. I think most of the county might even be powered by turkey poop. Yeah. So you know, where there's a will, there's a way, I guess.
That's cool.
Yeah.
No, that's great. It's nice to hear poop going to good use.
Yeah, I guess so. Why not? But, well, sir, I wish you luck. Appreciate the time today. And you got a website, or just do you direct people to the BOE report or Public Energy Number One or what?
Yeah, either one is good. And I write mostly for the BOE report. I haven't had time to keep up with both. And at the end of every, my posts are easy to find. They're just under columns, or I write every other week or something. And at the bottom of each post is a link where people want to email me, they're more than welcome to.